Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
What would you pack to spend the night far away from any grocery store, emergency room, or police station? What about spending your whole life in the wilderness? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Our distant ancestors' lives may have looked nasty, brutish, and short compared to our own, but their brains and bodies were exquisitely evolved to give them a fighting chance in very challenging conditions. Food wasn't always available, but when it was, they gorged themselves. Their affinity for salt helped keep them from dehydrating during exercise. Their natural vigilance drove them to avoid potential dangers, and their ability to form blood clots meant they could sometimes survive serious injury. In today's America, food is everywhere, buildings shelter us from predators and the elements, and we have sterile bandages and doctors to stitch up wounds. And since the world has changed, the very attributes that brought humankind into the 21st century has put us at risk for heart disease, hypertension, strokes, and crippling anxiety. Dr. Lee Goldman joins us to talk about this. He is Dean of the Faculties of Health Sciences and Medicine at Columbia University Medical Center. His new book is called Too Much of a Good Thing: How Four Key Survival Traits Are Now Killing Us. Dr. Goldman, welcome to Think.
Good morning. Thank you.
Natural selection made it possible for humans to persist in very harsh conditions, at least long enough to reproduce. But our bodies have not kept pace with the upgrades, if you will, to our environment. Is that right?
Very true. The key way to think about this, though, would be to say that when we think about the Stone Age, the Paleolithic Age, as we call it, human life expectancy was about 33 years. In 1840 in Europe, life expectancy was still 33 years. So the same challenge that people faced back in those very olden days, 10,000 generations ago or so, weren't particularly different than the challenges that our ancestors faced 7 or 8 or 9 generations ago. Surprisingly little had changed until that time.
Now the world is very different.
Now the world is very different. All of a sudden you have the Industrial Revolution. Instead of hunting, gathering, or farming food, we go to the supermarket. We don't have to walk and run places. We can take cars, elevators, and escalators. And things that used to be in short supply, like salt, which at one point was more precious than gold, are now overabundant, readily available, easy to get, and to get more of them than we need.
Many of us lament the fact that our bodies take excess calories and store them for us as fat. But without a guaranteed food supply, that tendency was a lifesaver.
That was probably the most important human trait that got us through those 10,000 generations. If you think about it, food was probably always in short supply. Hunter-gatherers were out there every day getting a new supply of nuts, berries, and perhaps an occasional animal. Even 10,000 years ago, when people settled down and began as farmers in the Neolithic age, it was still pretty precarious. So you had to have a way to survive, and the main way to do that was to be able to gorge and eat a lot of food that was available, to store it as fat, and then to be able to burn off that fat slowly during times when food was not so readily available. We're not built exactly like bears, who are obviously terrific at storing fat and sleeping through the whole winter. But we can store fat in our livers in much the same way that bears can do it.
We all know people who absolutely love to exercise, and we know people who absolutely loathe it. Is that wired into us, or is our desire for physical activity the product of natural selection?
Well, there's some of that wired into us. Some of us more so than others. There is a particular gene that about 10% of us have that makes us more likely to wander and to be more active. And interestingly, the farther away you get from Africa, the higher the percentage of people are who have this gene, suggesting that their ancestors were more likely to wander and to explore. But I think in terms of today, it's very hard for us to do the amount of activity that was routine back in the Paleolithic era. And even if we do, it turns out you don't burn off that many calories from exercising. I mean, if you're a biker, an Olympic biker, that's a different story. But for most of us, the ready availability of food, the amount of calories we can consume, can easily dwarf the amount of exercise we could reasonably be expected to do. And furthermore, many people who exercise then reward themselves. So you can do half an hour worth of exercise and negate all of that by one large muffin.
Right, or that juice bar next door to the gym.
Absolutely.
How is it that so many of us are driven to eat more than we need, given that most of us know exactly where our next meal is coming from and don't have to worry that there might not be food later on?
Sure. Well, some of this, much of this is hardwired, and that hardwiring includes our desire for sugars or sweets, our desire for salt, our desire for protein, and the fact that we like the taste of fat. When food was not all that available, we were very good at eating whatever was in front of us. Today, we're still very good at eating what's in front of us. Experiments have shown that if you put more food in front of people, they simply eat more. If you make it harder to get, we eat less. If we didn't have refrigerators, we didn't have candy sitting on the table, we didn't have snacks readily available, we would clearly eat less. But when we see food, we tend to want to eat it. And interestingly, our bodies don't really have a way of making us eat the things that we need. With the exception of our taste buds, we have no signal that says, hey, you need more calcium, go out and drink some milk. We get that mostly by the fact that we love diversity in our food supply. That's why if you go to a buffet, you'll eat more than if you order off the menu. It also explains the results of a very interesting experiment where people were given M&Ms. And first, let's agree that no matter what the color of the M&M tastes the same.
Right.
But if you give half of people M&Ms all of one color, other half M&Ms of varying colors, the people who are given M&Ms of varying colors will reliably eat 30 to 50% more M&Ms. Their brains somehow think that they're getting a more diverse diet. And so we not only want to eat, we want to eat variety. No matter how much you like chocolate, no matter how much you like steak, no matter how much you like whatever it may be, you'll fatigue if that's the only thing we give you. One of the best ways for people to lose weight, in fact, is to be given a very monotonous diet. The more monotonous the diet, the less we tend to eat.
So then ultimately you're just eating enough to fulfill your hunger because it's not fun anymore to consume food.
At least closer to that goal, mm-hmm. Yes.
You have a really interesting study that you write about in the book where some secretaries were given candy, and either there was a clear bowl of candy or something that was covered, and it was either on their desk or across the room, but they weren't told they could or could not have any particular amount.
Correct. But if the bowl is clear so you can see it, if it's within easy reach so you can get to it, you simply eat more. It's just, again, it's the way we're built. And obviously, food companies understand these issues and take advantage of them. They routinely try to increase the portion size. If you give people soup in little bowls versus bigger bowls, the people who get bigger bowls eat more soup. If you routinely refill the bowl without people knowing you're refilling the bowl, they eat more soup. These things are all hardwired, and obviously food companies, whose job it is to sell more food, recognize this and try to take advantage of it.
Today, our taste for very salty foods is understood to be a straight-up health hazard for a lot of people. What does a love of salt have to do with our ability to stay alive in tough situations?
Sure, good question. A couple of reasons why salt was always so important. First, as best as we can tell, one of the major advantages that humans have over other animals is our endurance. We can walk and run farther than other animals. We're not the fastest sprinters, but we can keep on going. In fact, in Wales, there's an annual race of horses against people. And it's marathon distance. The horses routinely win, except if it's really hot, people can beat horses. And the reason is that we're the best animal at sweating. And when you sweat, you have that sweat evaporate, and that evaporation cools off our body, so we don't overheat like other animals. A cheetah, which is the world's fastest sprinter, can sprint for about a mile. But if you put a cheetah on a treadmill, after it sprints for about a mile, it lies down and rolls off the treadmill because its temperature goes up to about 107 degrees. It's just too hot to keep on going. Because we can sweat, we can keep on going. But because we sweat, we lose water and salt. And if we don't have enough salt to hold on to that water, we'll get dehydrated and we'll die. Same thing will happen if we get an infectious disease and have terrible diarrhea, we'll get dehydrated and we die. So having enough salt is really critical. We don't really store excess salt like we store excess fat. If you have too much to eat, you get fatter and store those calories in fat. There's no real place to store the excess salt. You store maybe a little bit of it, but not a huge amount. So you need salt every day, and that's why we have this tremendous desire for salt to protect us against these dehydrating challenges that could kill us. We know that people have really valued salt for a long time. In fact, Roman soldiers were paid in salt rather than in gold in many cases. In fact, the word salary comes from the Roman word sal for salt. Hmm. That's how valuable salt has been throughout the ages.
Was it possible for our ancestors thousands of years ago to eat too much salt, or was it too hard to get?
It almost certainly was too hard to get. In fact, if you look at some remaining groups of peoples who have been isolated from civilization, their salt intake is generally much lower than our salt intake. They can get by on substantially less as long as they don't get dehydrated. Of course, if they do too much, they're going to be at risk. So it was very hard to get too much salt back then. The other point I would make is that too much salt is really not a problem over the short term. It's a problem over the long term. So in modern America, the main side effect of too much salt is high blood pressure. And a third of us have high blood pressure linked to our overconsumption of salt. But that's not something that develops in most people, at least in their teens or 20s. Sometimes it can be a problem, especially in pregnant women. But high blood pressure doesn't tend to kill you before you have children, and they can have children, so you can perpetuate the species despite too much salt intake or genes that drive that excess salt intake.
So if we are susceptible to that because of our genes, it is unlikely that we won't pass those on to the next generation.
Correct. So one of the big issues here in terms of survival of the species, people talk about survival of the fittest. Basically, that means not the people who live the longest or even necessarily live the healthiest. It's the ones who can have the most children who live to have the most children. And so anything that happens to people after they get through those reproductive years tends not to have much of an effect on the perpetuation of the species. There's some advantage to having grandmothers to help take care of the kids, and probably some advantages to men in the Paleolithic era through about age 40 or 45 because they became actually better hunters as they got more experience. But we didn't need people to live to be age 60 or 65 or 70 to perpetuate the species. So all these survival traits are really designed to get us to a certain stage in life. And now what we're seeing is that as life expectancy has increased from that 33 years or so in the Stone Age or Europe in 1840, now to age 75 or 80, we've got a lot of years here where the survival advantage is no longer relevant to our health. And these same things that helped us perpetuate the species, our ancestors perpetuate the species, are now making us sick.
My guest is Dr. Lee Goldman, Dean of the Faculties of Health Sciences and Medicine at Columbia University Medical Center and author of a new book called Too Much of a Good Thing, How Four Key Survival Traits Are Now Killing Us. You can be part of this conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Lee Goldman, Dean of the Faculties of Health Sciences and Medicine at Columbia University Medical Center. His new book is called Too Much of a Good Thing: How Four Key Survival Traits Are Now Killing Us. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. All right, I want to talk about our brains. The kind of vigilance that gave our ancestors a fighting chance in the face of serious threats is still with us. How does it play out in the absence of real physical harm?
Well, of course, there still is some real physical harm, but not nearly what people faced for the previous 200,000 years. We no longer get chased by woolly mammoths. We're no longer chasing animals across an open plain. But there are still risks, and we still have to be vigilant. The problem here is that we're miscalibrated. Back in the Paleolithic era, as best as one can tell, about 15% of people were probably killed violently, some by accidents, but oftentimes by fights with other humans. When people began to settle down in the Neolithic era about 10,000 years ago and started farming, the skeletal remains suggested about 25% of people were killed violently. By comparison, believe it or not, despite all the things we're hearing in terms of terrorist threats and wars, this is the time when people are least likely to be killed. In fact, right now in America, more people die each year from suicide than from all murder and war put together. In fact, twice as many people die from self-inflicted gunshots as get killed by guns. So what's happened is we've gone from a time when the danger was external, other people, challenging environment, wild animals, to one which is, by historic standards, remarkably safe. And we're also misprogrammed in terms of the things we're afraid of. We are naturally afraid of spiders and snakes. Show a little kid a picture of that, and they're scared. Little kids are not afraid of guns, and they're not afraid of automobiles, the things that might actually kill them. Those have to be learned. So our brains set for a very different era in terms of things that we're afraid of. And now what we're seeing are really two epidemics. One is anxiety, which is that fear taken to an inappropriate level. And by most estimates, about 30% of Americans will suffer from anxiety at some point during their life. And the second is depression. Now, back in the challenging caveman era, it made sense that if you lost a battle, you would withdraw, become submissive, hope you didn't get killed, and live to fight another day. That's still a good response to losing a battle, as long as you bounce back to fight or compete another day. If you don't, that's called depression. And an estimated 15 to 20% of Americans will suffer from depression during their lifetimes. That's that same submissive trait, losing a battle, having things go wrong, without the bounce back that's supposed to occur after a period of sort of self-reflection and regrouping.
It's hard to understand what the evolutionary purpose of suicide might be.
Well, it's an interesting question. We don't actually know how often people committed suicide in olden times. We do know that we know a couple of things, or at least we can infer a couple of things from what we see in behaviors, again, in groups of people who have been isolated from civilization for a long time. One is this concept of you lose a battle and you want to go off and try to recover. But the second is there are certainly traditions, actually in many cultures, even today, of elderly people who feel they'll be a burden on the younger people going off and dying, in essence committing suicide. Also people who lose honor, lose face, commit suicide. And there are cultures in which it's common historically for a woman to commit suicide when her husband dies. So there are some of these things that have persisted in a variety of cultures. Obviously, you can't perpetuate the species by having lots of suicide. Well, on the other hand, there is some tendency for people who believe that they are no longer useful, who think they're going to be a burden, who've lost their pride and feel they can't bounce back to commit suicide. Some of this may have been helpful for the, you know, the group of people not to have to deal with feeding or caring for elderly people or people who couldn't otherwise fend for themselves. But you're right. Of all the traits I talk about, it's the one that's sort of least easy to think about in terms of an historic survival trait.
I've wondered in the past if our problem today, our concern today about overparenting is tied to the fact that as parents we have anxieties for the survival of our children, and they are living in much, much, much safer conditions than they were even a century ago.
I think you're absolutely right. Clearly there's still challenges for parents and for children, but the things we need to protect our children from are not the same as in prior eras. They're unlikely to get killed by a wild animal, bitten by a snake, poisoned by a spider. They are more likely, of course, to get run over by a car. So there's still some things we need to protect our children against. But the biggest reason why human life expectancy is now roughly 2.5 times what it was in the mid-19th century is because so many fewer children die. People who made it to age 30 or 40 always had a pretty good chance of making it to age 60 or 70. But what's really changed in terms of human life expectancy, sort of at the two ends of the spectrum, one, the marked reduction in child and adolescent death, and secondly, longevity in people after age 65 or so.
Okay, on to blood clots. A great thing for people in pre-industrial societies. Women were giving birth without doctors present. People who suffered cuts and wounds had no emergency rooms. That clotting also makes us really susceptible to strokes and cardiovascular disease.
Exactly. And this was, to me, one of the more fascinating pieces because food and obesity, salt and high blood pressure, fear and anxiety and depression are all habits. And it's easy for people somehow to think about, well, those are things maybe I could try to change. But it's not really possible for us directly to change our blood's ability to clot by thinking better thoughts. But for all of these generations, whether it was from trauma or, as you said, from childbirth especially, we were at risk of bleeding. And childbirth is a great example of this because at the time of childbirth, the placenta breaks off. And when it does, the woman's uterus is looking sort of like your knee would look if you dragged it across the driveway, bleeding a little bit from everywhere. You've got to be able to clot or you bleed to death. And we have a whole series of proteins that help the blood clot. We also have little cell remnants called platelets that help the blood clot. We have to be really good at that. And the problem now is that it's unlikely we're going to bleed to death between the combination of bandages, stitches, blood transfusions, etc. But the leading causes of death in modern America are heart attacks and strokes. Heart attacks, blood clots in the arteries to the heart, strokes, predominantly blood clots in the arteries to the brain. So our clotting system is misset. This is one of the reasons why people talk about, should I take an aspirin every day? And certainly for people with a history of heart disease or stroke, it's clearly beneficial. For the rest of us over the age of 50 or so, it's a close call. It would be great if we had something that could be as effective as aspirin at preventing blood clots without simultaneously irritating our insides and causing us to bleed. But by and large, we'd be better off if we were just all slightly less likely to clot.
What if we gave, made statin drugs an over-the-counter drug in a lower form, lower dose? Or would more people benefit from taking those who don't have evidence of cardiovascular disease currently?
And this is not something I address directly in the book, but let me paint the background if I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Clots in the coronary arteries, the predisposing factor is atherosclerotic plaques, deposition of fat, low-density cholesterol, and statins reduce those levels. And as you probably know, the science behind that was really pioneered in Dallas by Michael Brown and Joseph Goldstein at the University of Texas Southwestern. Clearly, statins lower your LDL or bad cholesterol. As a result, make it less likely you'll have those plaques and less likely that they'll rupture and cause the cascade of events that lead to a heart attack. I personally believe, this is not directly related to the book, that making statins more readily available would be beneficial, and that on average their risk-benefit ratio is comparable to that of other things that have gone on the market. But let me talk about it also, if I may, in a slightly different direction, because another interesting study, also from Dallas, the Dallas Heart Study, looked at people in Dallas and measured their LDL or bad cholesterol levels, and surprisingly found one woman whose LDL cholesterol level was 14. We usually consider anything under 120 to be normal, under 100 to be good. For people who have had heart attacks, we try to drive it down to 60 or maybe 50. Her LDL cholesterol level was 14. And she was, and it is, as far as I know, perfectly healthy. Mm-hmm. So here's, and the reason is that she has two mutated copies, if you will, missing both normal copies of a PCSK9 gene, which is needed to give us the cholesterol levels that our bodies have historically thought they needed. And presumably back in the old days when nutrition was questionable, it was important for all of us to be sure we could make enough cholesterol, because you need cholesterol for every cell membrane in your body. But 14 is enough. Pretty much all of us have two copies of that gene and are making far more cholesterol than we need. This is a good example of too much of a good thing. All these genes that aren't crazy mutations, but rather things that almost all of us have and no longer need. Statins can't get you down to 14. Whether other drugs, including some of the newer drugs that can reverse the effects of PCSK9, can get people there is a different story. That's not going to be easy. But certainly, we'd all benefit if we could move everyone's cholesterol level to be substantially lower.
What does it take for a new, potentially beneficial mutation to work its way through a significant percentage of the population?
Well, depending on how beneficial it is, it can make it through the population in 100 generations. You know, since we've been around for probably 10,000 generations, that's pretty quick. Mm-hmm. But if each generation is 20 or 25 years, that's a long time. So, you know, if you think about the rate at which these mutations can spread, it's, you know, on an evolutionary basis, if you will, pretty fast. A good example that I talk about in the book is skin color. So originally in Africa, we all had dark skin. As people moved to other parts of the world, skin became progressively lighter. The reason, as best as we can tell, is because we absorb the sun's vitamin D through our skin. We need that for our bones and to absorb calcium. And if you look at skin color of indigenous people, wherever they may happen to be, it almost perfectly parallels their latitude. Skin's a little bit darker in the southern hemisphere than the northern hemisphere because of the amount of ultraviolet light that's seen there. But it's almost perfectly calibrated. Why do people in sunny areas have dark skin rather than light skin? They wouldn't presumably die from light skin. Well, actually, it turns out that too much sunlight degrades your folic acid. And as every pregnant woman knows, folic acid is one of those pills you take so that your baby's nervous system develops normally. So too much sun with light skin, you don't have enough folic acid. Not enough sun with dark skin, you don't have enough calcium because you don't have enough vitamin D. So skin color tends to be remarkably well titrated by latitude. There's only one major exception. Those are the Inuit Indians. And the Inuits are interesting because their diet, which is largely fish and occasional polar bear, is very high in not only vitamin A, but also vitamin D. They eat the whole animal. Hmm. They get plenty of vitamin D. They don't really need sunlight. And their skin is a bit darker, in part because of the reflection of sun off of the the polar ice cap. But other than the Inuits, skin color and latitude tend to be incredibly well titrated. And those are survival advantages that appeared over probably about 1,000 years or so, 1,000 years is a pretty short time in the history of humanity. But it's a long time if you're trying to deal with an obesity epidemic today.
There are some mutations that spread despite being neutral or regardless of being neutral. They don't necessarily help people procreate, but they don't hurt. Could you take us through this really interesting thought exercise in the book about the HIV virus, which a very small percentage of people appear to be immune to? Had it appeared, you know, thousands of years ago instead of in the 20th century, the consequences of that infection might have been as if it's possible, vastly more devastating than they have been.
Sure. So we each have about 3 billion letters, if you will, as part of our genetic code. They're called base pairs. We get about 3 billion from each of our parents. Well, on average, each of us has about 60 that are different from those of our parents, just by chance. The inherent rate of typographical error, if you will. Those things that change can be fatal, so a baby is never born. They can cause disease at various times of life. They can also be neutral, even though you spell something differently, like gray, G-R-A-Y versus gray, G-R-E-Y. The meaning is still the same, and what the DNA codes for is unchanged. But over time, these mutations can add up. And what they then serve as is the sort of substrate, if you will, for future selection. If by chance you have one of these mutations and it's going to protect you from some future threat, you and your children do better and you have more of your own descendants. If it's something that's going to be bad, you don't do as well and you have fewer descendants. And HIV, which I can talk about in more detail in a moment, is one of those examples.
My guest is Dean of the Faculties of Health Sciences and Medicine at Columbia University Medical Center, Dr. Lee Goldman. His new book is called Too Much of a Good Thing: How Four Key Survival Traits Are Now Killing Us. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Dr. Lee Goldman of Columbia University Medical Center. His new book is Too Much of a Good Thing: How Four Key Survival Traits Are Now Killing Us. And Dr. Goldman, you were about to tell us a little bit about the timing of the arrival of the HIV virus in the human population.
Sure. So HIV, as best we can tell, is a relatively new virus. It came from Africa. It came from primates. It probably first infected humans in the 1920s or 30s or so and spread rather rapidly, mostly by sexual contact, although it can be spread also by blood and other body secretions. It turns out that a very small percentage of humans have genetic mutations that help protect them against HIV. HIV gets into your lymphocytes, your immune cells, via a particular receptor. Most of them use a receptor called CCR5. The name is not that all important. But if you have a mutation in that receptor, the HIV can't get in. And about 10% of Europeans have a mutation from one parent, so they only have half as many of those receptors. And about 1% get it from both parents, so they don't have any of those receptors. Those people are remarkably protected from most forms of HIV. They simply don't get infected, don't have persisting infection, don't develop AIDS. And we don't really know why this mutation is around. There was speculation that maybe it protected people from previous infectious diseases, but so far nothing has really been found to support that. But we do know that the presence of this receptor makes you get a more severe form of West Nile virus, And presumably that's why this receptor mutation is not found in people in Africa, would be frankly deleterious. What's interesting for the book is that there's one case, the so-called Berlin patient, a man who had a severe HIV and actually in the pre-modern treatment era developed full-blown AIDS, and then, talk about bad luck, also developed leukemia. And when they gave him his medications for leukemia, which suppresses your immune system, his and they had to stop some of his viral medications, his AIDS really flared. Doctors knew he needed a bone marrow transplant to treat his leukemia. They actually found a donor who was missing both copies of this receptor gene, so would be immune to getting AIDS, got the bone marrow transplant from this donor, and remarkably, the bone marrow transplant cured his leukemia, and these mutations fought off his HIV and AIDS, and now, more than 5 years later, he's the only person in the world known to be totally cured of HIV infection.
Wow.
Why this mutation is around, we don't really know. It may be one of those simply random things that occurred and perpetuated without any major advantage. It may have had some advantage, but as best we can tell, about 10% of Europeans have had this mutation for at least several thousand years. So it's, at least recently, it's not had a major survival advantage until HIV came along, and now suddenly it's a wonderful mutation to have.
Is this being investigated, this like bone marrow transplants for people who have HIV from those who have the, this protective gene?
Well, the problem is it's really hard to find someone who is compatible for a bone marrow transplant. It usually these are relatives. It's very hard to find an unrelated living donor. And then to find an unrelated living donor also happens to be the 1 in 100 with this mutation, that's really unlikely. People have tried just giving bone marrow transplants because that can sometimes rev up your immune system. And that's had some benefit, but not enough to cure HIV. There is a drug that blocks this receptor, but it can't block it sufficiently to cure HIV.
We have an email here from Joey in Denton who says, I recently heard that the best way to maintain one's weight is to take 16,000 steps or more a day. That would be about 8 miles. Does this square with early humans and our nomadic lifestyle?
It certainly helps. There's a lot of false information suggesting that if you only eat something different, it matters. The reality is that a calorie is pretty much a calorie is pretty much a calorie. Some suggest that if you snack as opposed to gorging all at once, you may hold on a little bit more to your weight. But by and large, it's really calories in versus calories expended with exercise. So the more you walk, the better off you are. The problem with trying to lose weight, though, is different. The reality is that as soon as you start to lose weight, whether it's by dieting, by exercising more, by whatever you may try to do, you will get more hungry. That's a protective mechanism, going back to the Paleolithic era. Not only that, your metabolic rate will slow down, so you burn fewer calories. All these are hardwired, built-in traits designed to protect us from starving to death. The problem is that the same hormones that make us hungrier and slow down our metabolism when we try to lose weight do it whether we try to lose weight from a normal weight to being too skinny or from being frankly obese to just trying to lose a couple of pounds. And that's why it's so hard to lose weight, whether you do it, as I said, by primarily dieting or by trying to exercise. This whole set of hormones will kick in and say, save my weight, protect my weight, don't let me lose weight. That's got to be bad for humans and human survival. Great trait to have in the Paleolithic era, not a great trait to have now.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Desiree in Keller. Hi, Desiree.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, great. So, I have a question. So, I don't know if you can answer it directly or just maybe you could speak to it. But I wondered if people who tend to be bleeders, how that correlates with cholesterol. And the reason I'm asking is because I have really good cholesterol, like 214, but it's like 150 or 60 on the HDL and like 40 or 45 on the LDL, which is really great, right? Very protective. but I'm also not anemic, but I'm a bleeder through VV when I had my two kids. I remember the doctor wanted to keep me an extra day because she was just like, you bleed a lot. I just want to make sure everything's healed up properly.
Well, is there any relationship, Dr. Goldman?
No direct relationship. In other words, the genes that control cholesterol don't control your clotting proteins or your platelets directly. So this may just be, you know, presumably just serendipity. People who truly have mild clotting abnormalities are actually somewhat less likely to get heart attacks and strokes because they're less likely to form those clots in the arteries to their hearts and to their brains. People who have low LDLs, LDL of 45 is terrific, are also less likely to have heart attacks and strokes. So you may be in good shape on both sides. Well, I have to say, a lot of people who say they are, quote, bleeders, unquote, don't really have any underlying bleeding abnormality. There are other people who do, you do need, as you said, to stay in the hospital for an extra day sometimes after things like childbirth.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Now we have Terry on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Terry.
Hi. Really enjoying the conversation. I have a little disagreement with your guest in that I don't believe that depression and anxiety are necessarily habits that we can overcome. There's a lot of evidence that they are conditioned responses. And I would ask your guest, given the fact that the fight or flight reflex was meant, as you said, to help us in times of either encountering a cave bear or a saber-toothed tiger, what do we do now when we're stuck in work situations where we cannot either fight, we'll get fired, or flee, we'll lose our jobs?
So let me say, I misspoke or perhaps was misunderstood. Anxiety and depression, those traits, they are hardwired. They're in our genes. There was a time when it was common to say that people who were anxious or depressed were weak-willed. There was something wrong with their ability or whatever. We now know that these are hardwired. There are behavioral ways we can try to address them, but most of these traits are hardwired, just like our clotting is hardwired. In terms of the responses to these sorts of situations where you can't do what our Paleolithic ancestors did, there are really two kinds of approaches. One is behavior modification, and there are some programs and some approaches that can help people deal with those stresses somewhat better, recognizing that the traits are hardwired, but we still have at least a little bit of control over them, just like hunger is hardwired. We have some control over that. And some people require medications. I'm not here to try to put everyone on medicines, but I will say there are situations in which, as we discussed, your genes can't change fast enough, and conscious behaviors can't overcome all of our genetic traits, and that's where medications can sometimes be helpful. That's why statins are much more successful on average than diet for lowering cholesterol levels, why blood pressure medications are much more successful than diet and exercise in people who have high blood pressure. And there will be people for whom anxiety, depression, and these fight-or-flight traits can't be completely reversed or blunted by learned behavior and do require medication.
Your approach is interesting. There are people who say that if these conditions could be, ameliorated with behavioral modifications, that that should always be the way to go, and that, a need for medication is sort of a sign that the patient is noncompliant or just doesn't care enough. It sounds like your approach to this is pragmatic. If you look at 100 patients and more than half of them get better with the drugs and fewer than half get better with behavior, then the drugs work better than behavior.
Pragmatic is a term I like to pick up on. No one would argue that it wouldn't be preferable to change your habits rather than to rely on medications. But if changing habits were routinely successful, 38% of Americans wouldn't be obese, 1/3 of Americans wouldn't have hypertension, 20% of Americans wouldn't have anxiety, and heart attacks and strokes wouldn't be the leading causes of death, and I wouldn't have written this book. The reality is that we should not think of people as being weak-willed or unvirtuous because their genes may be driving them in these directions. We should not say that this is all mind over matter, just work harder and you can get there. Some people can and some people can't. And many times that's because their genetic makeup is different. I'd be the first to say let's try behavior change when we can for most things, but behavior change is not going to be effective for people who have high blood pressure. By the time you develop high blood pressure, even if you reduce your salt intake, even if you exercise more, you can only lower your blood pressure a little bit, and you're highly unlikely to be able to avoid medications. Medications can save your life, prevent a stroke, prevent a heart attack. Trying to perseverate, if you will, on behavior change in situations in which it doesn't work, and sometimes can't possibly work, I think is counterproductive. That can make me sound like a doctor pushing medications. I would argue that your use of the term pragmatic is a better way to describe that. This is all a balance. If you can do it naturally, that's great. But every doctor who's ever taken care of someone with high blood pressure will tell you the first thing a patient asks is, "Doc, can I exercise more and change my diet and lose some weight and beat this high blood pressure?" And the message is, perhaps we can try it for a month, but we can't have you pretend that that's going to be the solution while we watch your blood pressure get higher and higher and watch you increase your risk for a stroke.
Can we direct our own evolution, if it is unlikely to happen the old-fashioned way, to match our bodies to the environment that we live in the modern world?
Well, we started getting into things like eugenics that people don't like to talk about, and I don't really want to talk about, truly changing the genes that we pass on to our kids. That's one issue. A different issue is, can we modify the effects of those genes in us, the genes that we have too much of, that we don't really need? Sometimes we can do it without affecting the genes themselves. That's what happens when we treat high blood pressure. Sometimes we can affect things downstream, like we do with statins and some other medications that lower your cholesterol level. And sometimes, as with PCSK9, we may find drugs that actually blunt the gene itself. We don't have that yet. Right now we have an antibody. But those are some of the possibilities here in terms of treating these traits. My point here would be that over the short term, if we can't evolve quickly enough, and if we can't routinely be successful with behavior change, there will be a need to think about medications and interventions that can shift the way these genes work, blunt their adverse effects, and help us live longer and healthier lives.
Dr. Lee Goldman is Dean of the Faculties of Health Sciences and Medicine at Columbia University Medical Center. His new book is called Too Much of a Good Thing: How Four Key Survival Traits Are Now Killing Us. Dr. Goldman, thank you so much for making this time for us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.